Very good.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Matthew Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say today's date is May 20, 2020, in the year 2021. This is the second case on today's agenda. Case number A20-1504 in the matter of the trust agreement of Julian M. Johnson. I assume counsel are familiar with our procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your arguments initially, and then appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and then begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Francis Rondoni. I represent the appellants in this case, Karen Carlson and Diane Waller. The issues stated in the brief are three, but they really come down to two. The first issue is whether or not the court has misconstrued the language of the trust, indicating that the word shall means that the income must be distributed. And secondly, whether or not the behavior of the trustees constituted a breach of duty of loyalty and duty of impartiality. The district court awarded summary judgment despite the fact that there are material facts that are in dispute on those two issues. I will briefly touch on the facts. Julian Johnson executed a trust. It was an inter vivos trust on October 5th, 2010.
Mr. Rondoni, we're probably very familiar with the facts. Let me go to your introduction. I was wondering whether this all kind of comes down to one issue. And the one issue to me that seems to be at the core of the dispute is whether the trustee was obligated to make more of an inquiry to determine the surviving spouse's other income in order to determine whether she has adequate other income, which might then be an exception to the shall distribute income provision in paragraph 6.11. Isn't that kind of the source of all of the issues in dispute?
It is the main issue, Your Honor. Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. And you could argue that that is really the key issue that's here today. So let me address that 6.1.
Okay, and so I guess I'm not entirely clear. I mean, if we were to conclude that the trustee did nothing improper or did not fail to do something that the trustee should have done, if given that premise, can any of your claims survive or prevail?
Yes. Even if the court were to determine that the district court's interpretation of 6.1.1 was correct, the duty of impartiality and the duty of loyalty to the other beneficiaries are still separate issues that would support a remand of the case and, frankly, an appointment of a neutral trustee.
Okay, I'll let you elaborate. Thank you.
Thank you. So the key here is 6.1.1. Which indicates that the trustee shall distribute the income to my spouse, provided that to the extent the independent trustees determine that my spouse has adequate other income, such trustee may then do one of two things. He can give money to the other beneficiaries, or he can just hold the income in the trust.
Let's look at that exact paragraph. And I think what Judge Johnson is getting at is we have a clause, the trustee shall distribute to my spouse. What do you do with the semicolon? What does that infer as far as your argument is concerned?
So my argument is that that is what the initial step is in terms of analysis by the trustee.
Distributing. Well, it clearly doesn't mean a conjunction such as and or some other word that would indicate they have to be read together. That's what I'm getting at. What are we to make of that? Because we look at the intent of the grantor when we're interpreting trusts.
Correct. So there's a number of different ways to look at the intent of the grantor. The first one is, if you take a look at this court's decision in Flygare, the language is nearly identical. And this court said that that type of language indicates a support trust. Secondly, the provision later on about withholding and accumulating income in the trust only makes sense if there is a provision and a process by which the trustee is going to determine whether or not adequate income has been given to whether his wife has adequate income and resources. Third, if you take
I hate to keep interrupting you, and I'm sorry, but you're relying on FlyGear, if that's the correct pronunciation. And obviously that was a reimbursement of income trust. Are you trying to say that this trust was the same, that it was set up as far as benefits?
Yes, the language is nearly identical. It indicates that net income of this trust shall be paid to my spouse in quarterly or other convenient installments, semicolon.
What I'm getting at is, you know, you yourself said FlyGear is a support trust. I don't know that this is a support trust. It sounds like it was very clearly a discretionary trust.
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit the fact, if you look at the affidavit submitted by the attorney who drafted it, he said that the intent of the settlor was to provide support for his wife, not just income for life, period, but support. And that would also be consistent with the way that the FlyGear court interpreted it. So here's the language from this court's decision. The clear purpose of this trust was to ensure that the appellant's basic needs are met. She thus has the ability to bring an action to compel the trustee to do what the trustee needed to do, which was to provide her income. Now, in FlyGear, the issue was that the individual was actually applying for medical assistance and said she had no assets. And the court said, you have a support trust that requires to give you enough to take care of you. But I think that this court's interpretation of that would be consistent with the language that is here in this, which is that the rest of that language doesn't make any sense if you take a look at the totality of the circumstances. And the case law here is very clear. We have to read the trust as a whole and not focus on just one word or two words. If you take a look at the amount of money that he left her, $1.8 million, that there are 10 children that are relying on what's left in the trust, and that he specifically put in there, provided, which actually limits the trustee's power in terms of giving her income. And that is the simplest and the most consistent way to read all of that language. Certainly, one could argue there's a fact issue there as to what he intended, in which case this case should be remanded. But it is our position that that language is clear, that the trustee has a duty to make some inquiry as to what her actual needs are here.
And what is the source of that duty, the duty to inquire?
The plain language of the trust that says, provided that to the extent the independent trustee determines my spouse has adequate other income. So there are no Minnesota cases that look at this from the viewpoint that we have here today. If you look at FlyGear and some of the other cases, they talk about actually requiring payment to be made by the trustee. But we did cite a case from Ohio and New York that did look at it from the other point of view, that it's an abuse of discretion by the trustee not to go through that process. It would not, it simply does not make sense to read this, that the trustee has to give her all of the income and then may do something else later on. Those would be inconsistent, particularly if he's just accumulating income in the trust, which is one of the things that the trustee has discretion to do. It is our position that—
Before you go forward, Mr. Rondoni, so I was wondering, I asked a minute ago, what's the source of the duty? And I think you're pointing at paragraph 6.1.1. Is there any other provision elsewhere in the trust, perhaps, you know, an article or section about trustee powers and duties that relates to this at all? Or are we really just focused in on paragraph 6.1.1? Is that the only provision that's relevant to our inquiry?
I really think that it is. I mean, the trustee has discretion in making distributions under certain circumstances. The trustee is supposed to exercise independent judgment. But the trustee is also supposed to follow the plain language of the trust and to give meaning to the settlor's intentions here, which it is our position was clearly laid out that he wanted to take care of his fourth wife, but that she was very well taken care of. And if taken care of, the trustee would either give the money to the successor beneficiaries or accumulate it in the trust.
I mean, there is no language there that says the trustee shall make a determination as to whether or not the surviving spouse has adequate other income. And also, it doesn't go any further about how the trustee should or could make that determination. It doesn't say the trustee shall ask the surviving spouse for certain information or for documents or for tax returns or for other, you know, asset statements. Doesn't say anything like that. I mean, so I think what you're asking us to do is to perhaps sort of add some language to that or add a term. I mean, to extrapolate quite a bit from what text we have to impose upon the trustee some procedural duties or some obligations to make all those inquiries and to make a determination one way or the other and then to act on it. And I mean, that 6.1.1 is just not that extensive.
The court is right. It does not use the language that the court indicated, and that would be very helpful here today. But the language does indicate that there should be at least some review of her need. And in this case, he has not done that. He admits that. He said, look, I don't think I have to do that. I don't know what her expenses are. I don't know what her assets are. I never inquired of that. He testified, the trustee testified that I'm giving her money that she asked for and I'm helping her to live in the manner that she was used to living. And that language is also not in the trust either. There is a certain amount of discretion the trustee has here. And the discretion, however, must be exercised in a reasonable manner, and it must be exercised in a way to give meaning to all of what's in the trust. And it's our position that that does require some review of her financial need to determine whether or not she, well, in the last 2 years, has been given $550,000 out of the trust. And essentially what is happening from our point of view, if you look at the other material in our brief, he has a very close relationship with her. He pretty much gives her whatever she wants. And he has a duty to the other beneficiaries to be sure that as much of the trust is available to them as well as to her.
So my next question was going to be, so if the trustee, let's assume for the moment the trustee has a duty to do something, to make some inquiry, to obtain some information, why was that hypothetical duty not satisfied in this case?
By his own admission, he did not inquire of her of what her financial need was. He does not know what her assets are. He didn't know what her expenses were. I mean, just some basic information that would have been evidence that he had made that inquiry. He said that I asked her what she needed to live and I gave her that amount of money. And that was it. So if there is a...
Why is that inadequate? I mean, that seems to go directly to the issue of whether she has adequate other income.
So he testified not that he determined that whether she had adequate other income. He simply said, I gave her what she asked me to give her. And that is not an inquiry. Now, the trust language, as the court has pointed out, does not say what kind of inquiry has to be made, but some reasonable inquiry has to be made because he owes a duty to the other beneficiaries as well. And so at least some inquiry as to her assets and income would have to be made. He did none in this case.
Mr. Rendoni, I'm wondering if you could just clarify for us what the factual issues in the case would be. I'm a little unclear about, you know, what is the legal question to be determined as a matter of law under the circumstances of this case, and what are possibly factual issues.
Thank you, Your Honor. I can address that. I'm running short on time, so I will be brief. So the facts that are laid out on the brief indicated that he intentionally withheld information from the beneficiaries. In his emails, that's clear. He reviewed and revised information that came from the accountant to disguise or limit access of the beneficiaries as to the amount of money that was going to Joanne, the surviving spouse. And I could even quote from his emails here that giving the beneficiary some money was to quote unquote get rid of the problem. In December of 2018, he was talking to the accountant. He said, in equity wire, the distribution shown, will these be carried forward on future statements? If so, put them under a single heading. Again, the intent is to withhold information. And I'm running short on time. There are other facts laid out in there, but those go to whether or not he is a proper person to be a trustee in this case. And the duty of impartiality and the duty of loyalty requires him to give the same deference to all of the beneficiaries and not to prefer the surviving spouse. Does that answer the court's question?
And if you would like more time to give a more complete answer, you should feel free to take it to ensure that Judge Gaitis' question is answered. It's up to you.
So the last one I would point out, in an email dated December 31, 2018, he said, quote, I'm sending out third quarter financials today to all beneficiaries and will copy Mr. Rondoni, but for the moment, I'm not going to provide him with information on distributions. That is not the behavior of a trustee who is neutral and exercising a duty of loyalty and a duty of impartiality. So even if the court were to determine that the language of the trust was ambiguous as to his duties, we should be entitled to a trial on that issue, and we should also be entitled to a trial on the issue as to whether or not the acts and omissions of the trustees here constitute a breach of fiduciary duty. Thank you.
I have one more question at this time. Does the summary judgment record include any deposition testimony or not? Just exhibits.
My recollection is it's very limited in terms of the amount of deposition testimony that was in there. I did not anticipate that question, Your Honor, so I don't know that I can answer it directly, but I know that there are references to the record in there.
Thank you, Mr. Rondoni. As I said earlier, you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and your clients and then begin. You're muted, Mr. Kletcher.
Good morning. Apologize for that.
It's okay.
May it please the court. Bradley Kletcher of Barnaguzzi and Stephan on behalf of the respondents, Thomas Stoltman and Joanne Johnson. This case, as the court has focused in on it, really focuses on the issue of paragraph 6.11 of the trust. And that is the essential issue that's before the court in this particular case. To address Your Honor's question that was asked right towards the end about whether there are deposition transcripts in the record, there are, in fact, deposition transcripts in the record. The depositions of Mr. Stoltman and of Ms. Waller and Ms. Carlson are all in the record before the court, and that testimony is actually referenced in our appellate briefs. Your Honors, I think you hit the point correctly on the head when you talked about paragraph 6.1.1. And the important part is reading paragraph 6.1.1 with paragraph 6.1.2. They are two different types of paragraphs. And as Your Honors pointed out, if you look at paragraph 6.1.1, the language is separated by a semicolon. And the impact of that is that we have two independent clauses as a matter of grammar. The first sentence being that the distribution shall be made. That is an independent sentence. The second part of it being there's a proviso that allows the trustee to have discretion to distribute to the other beneficiaries. And the reason that's placed there is for tax purposes. It's one of those institutions where if there's too high of a tax being paid by the income recipient, in this case, Joanne Johnson, the trustee then has discretion to give other income to the other beneficiaries. And that's why that language is placed in there, and that's why it exists in that particular way.
But 6.1.1 doesn't say anything about taxes.
That is true, it does not, but it does say, use the words other adequate income in the proviso portion. But that's the reason that it is there. And that's the testimony from Mr. Heefner that is in the record. That testimony is undisputed.
And what's his connection to the case?
He was the drafter of the trust document. He was the one who was the attorney for Julian Johnson and Joanne Johnson when this trust was put together. If you look at paragraph 6.1.2, it's drafted in a completely different manner. Paragraph 6.1.2 focuses the attention on the support maintenance for Joanne Johnson and specifically says if there are other funds that are insufficient to meet her needs. It spells it out in a much different manner. And the words that are used there shows that with regard to principal, a different inquiry has to be made. And that's a different situation than what you have in paragraph 6.1.1. As the court points out, 6.1.1 does not require any inquiry to be made. It's not specified in there that an inquiry has to be made. 6.1.1 instead provides that the income shall be distributed to Joanne Johnson. That language is clear and unequivocal. And because of that language, the trustee acted in the manner that he did. Now, the trustee in this particular case relied on his conversation with Joanne Johnson when they set the amount of money. And we've quoted his deposition testimony. It's doc index number 32, and it's a Stoltman deposition of page 18, pages lines 6 to 19, where he talked to her about what her needs were to maintain the style of living that she had when she was married to Julian Johnson, the amount of income that she needed to do that. And she originally wanted $75,000. He didn't just agree to that. He talked with her more about what their situation was and what her standard of living was. He knew that she had three houses to maintain that she received and continued to have after her husband's death. And she he talked to her about cost of living that she had and arrived at the number that they had. Now, there's no Minnesota case that says any inquiry has to be made of this. The Flygear case and the Wilcox case, which we've cited to the court, deal with medical assistance issues. They do not deal with situations where you're looking at whether a beneficiary can bring a claim and require somebody to make further inquiry than they already did. And that's a completely different situation. The cases from New York and Ohio that are cited by the appellants deal with a different type of trust. Those trusts actually deal with language similar to 6.1.2. The language them is not dealing with the language that we're dealing with here. The interesting thing I think about the Clark's case is they actually indicate in there that, and this is on page 163 of the New York opinion, coupled with its own general knowledge of the situation and the needs of the beneficiary, the trustee was entitled to rely upon the representations of the caregiver for the beneficiary as the details of the expenditures were not required. So the court actually said, you can just talk to somebody about what their needs are, and that's sufficient to meet your standard of care. And that dealt with a provision dealing with 6.1.2, not the provision of 6.1.1. So that actually, even if that standard were to apply for 6.11, which it does not, would have been met in this particular situation based on the deposition testimony that was provided by Mr. Stoltman in the case. As a result of that—
I have a question. I appreciate that comment about the Clark opinion. I guess I'm interrupting because I thought you might be going to a different topic, and I have a question that's more closely related to this. Is there evidence in the record about the trustee's personal familiarity with both the grantor and the surviving spouse? I thought I read perhaps that they were neighbors or acquaintances or friends, but, you know, in other words, I'm wondering whether that would allow an inference that just due to personal interactions, he has an opportunity to observe her standard of living and both before and after the grantor's death. Is there anything in the record such as that?
There is evidence in the record in Mr. Stoltman's testimony about he was a friend of Julian Johnson. He was neighbors to them. So they do know each other. They are familiar with each other. And certainly they have conversations related to her situation and what she's involved with. And that's reflected in the record and in the deposition testimony. And that testimony is undisputed. It's not a situation where you have testimony that says, no, he didn't know of these things. it's undisputed that he did when was familiar with her, and he testified to that fact. You can see it actually in the questions. He's familiar with the fact that she's got three houses to continue to maintain, that she has continued expenses related to the upkeep of those houses. So he is very familiar with the situation that she's involved in and knew it from years before and continuing on. So this isn't something that's comes as a surprise. This other issues, and they're raised and they were touched on very briefly by Mr. Rondoni at the end of the argument, relate to the duty of impartiality, and it revolves these communications. But we addressed these directly in our briefing because we wanted to be clear exactly what transpired. So the first one is the email to the accountant. That's December 6th of 2018. And in that email, the trustee talks to the accountant about giving less specifics about the distributions in it. And they say that shows impartiality. What they failed to tell the court is that when the distributions were actually sent out, when they actually went through, when he finally determined what to put in the to the financial accountings, they disclosed specifically what the distributions were to Joanne Johnson and lay it out. So there wasn't any information that was withheld. And the appellants testified that they received those financial statements. So there is no dispute of fact that they did in fact receive that information and were told about it. The second point they argue about is the December 31st email, where Mr. Rondoni requested on December 27th some information on financials. On December 31st, Mr. Stoltman said he wasn't going to provide details on distributions. He testified in his deposition. The reason for that is he was concerned. He wanted to make sure he treated everybody equitably. 33 minutes after he sent that email to Joanne Johnson, he sent an email with the full amount of the distributions laid out. And he disclosed that information to them, having thought of it through and determined that it was equitable to do that. So the actual information that they're complaining about, they were provided that information. Later on in February, when Mr. Rondoni asked for additional information, the trustee responded to that, laid out and explained why the amounts of money were broken out, why they were done the way they were, and specifically indicated some of the distributions were for separate years and explained why they were done that way and why they were in separate years. So that information was provided to them. And the district court reviewed the record, found that there were no issues of fact appropriately because these are in emails, these are in documents. There's no dispute. You're not going to put somebody on the stand that says one thing and another person on the stand that is going to say another thing. So there's no genuine issues of material fact to have or determined to have a trial on. It's in the written record. Your Honors, this is simply a case where we have two children who are upset and are trying to get more money from the trust. The trustee acted in an appropriate manner, followed his obligations in a neutral manner in applying it. As an attorney of 43 years, Mr. Stoltman is honoring his obligations. He's honoring them to Julian Johnson and doing what Julian Johnson wanted. And for that reason, and for the fact that this record supports the decision of the district court, I ask this court to affirm the district court's decision. Unless there's any other questions, I don't have anything further to present.
It appears there are none.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Kletcher. Mr. Rondoni, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you very much. I'm going to focus my argument on the interpretation of 6.1.1 and some of the case law that supports our position. I'm going to call to the court's attention the Pamela Andrea Stisser grantor case, where the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota said that the courts must consider the grantor's dominant intention, which a court must gather from the instrument as a whole, not isolated words. In this case, the document as a whole would indicate that there should be some analysis as to her income and her expenses, and that really was not done here, certainly not anything that would be adequate beyond what she wanted. The drafter of the trust, Mr. Kletcher's partner, indicated that this was a support trust, that the income was to go to her for support. So there appears to be in the record some room for a factual finding about what the testator's, you know, what the settler's intent was. If we take a look at the Wilcox case, which is also a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2009, this court held the trustees have no discretion to withhold trust income necessary to meet the beneficiary's needs. Here, we're not talking about meeting her needs. We're talking about giving her whatever she wants. If you take a look at the Margolis case, which is also cited in our materials, the most important duty of a trustee is to trust beneficiaries is the duty of loyalty. And part of the quote from that case says this, except as the power is for the trustee's personal benefit, the court will also prevent the trustee from failing to act either arbitrarily or from a misunderstanding of the trustee's duty or authority. We have in this case serious factual issues as to what the settler's intent was. It's our position that the trust is clear, that there was a required reasonable inquiry as to her need and her income that was not done. If this court can read it differently, then it is ambiguous and we should have a trial on the issue as to that specific fact. In terms of the duty of impartiality and duty of loyalty, certainly the trustees were responsive when the beneficiaries complained, but their duty is to be even-handed, their duty is to be fair, their duty is to consider the beneficiaries as a whole and not just to favor one over the other. And there are serious fact issues here that would indicate that as well. So what we are asking this court to do is to remand the case back to the district court for a proper interpretation of the trust and for a trial on the issues of breach of fiduciary duty. Unless you have any other questions, I don't have anything further for the court.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That is the final case for oral argument today for this panel. So we are now adjourned.